Christmas time in Ireland in 1962, and a baby is born. Hello there, and welcome to a special bookish conversation with me, Kate Evans, here on ABC Radio National. We're talking Ireland, every day an extraordinary drama, fair days, greying underpants, and acute observation with the writer Niall Williams. He's written many books, but now spends all his imaginative time in the town of Fahar, the site of his novels History of the Rain, This is Happiness, and his latest, Time of the Child. I spoke to him earlier this year on stage at Adelaide Writers' Week. So let's join him on a journey to Fahar.
Fahar is a fictional village in the southwest of Ireland, on the Shannon estuary. So it's just there on the edge of the Shannon where the tide is coming and going, and it's out to America basically and coming into Limerick. And it's a place that's not noticed. It has no tourism. It's a place off the beaten track. It's a place largely forgotten. It doesn't feature in any history book. Nothing significant in Irish history has happened there. Nobody came from there that was of any note. And that's what attracts me to it. There's just two streets, Church Street and Main Street, which is a generalisation. But anyway, so those two streets, the church and the community centre across from it, the post office, all the things we expect in an Irish village. It's just that. But its main remarkableness is being unremarkable, which seemed to me the most important thing, that as a sort of metaphor for all of us as we live, most of us feeling, I think, that we are sort of unremarkable, and which is the remarkable thing actually about human beings. So the place is part of the nature of the people, and it rains there a lot. And it rains there so much that people have stopped talking about the rain because they just accept it. And it's part of that condition of that life there. So I first came to the idea of Fahar in writing History of the Rain. But in that novel, it's narrated by Ruth in a bedroom, and she never walks out in the town. She's ill, and she writes the whole novel from her imagination up in her room, where her father has died and left her all his books. And so she's trying to understand what happened to her father through stories and reading books. And so when I wrote This is Happiness, I wanted to go myself out and walk in Fahar and see what it was like.
In its ordinariness, it seems that it is also both beautiful and bleak, or perhaps bleak and beautiful, and that poverty is also something that's described the history of this town.
Yes. I think I don't mean to make it into a sort of Shangri-La or Brigadoon or something like that. Fahar is poor. Fahar has hardship. And the people are all the time dealing with that, I think. So I think that's part of the condition of everybody's life. And it is the same in Fahar as elsewhere. Industry passes by. There's nothing coming to Fahar. There's no attractions in Fahar that bring people there other than the people who are living there. So it has hardship and difficulty, and people emigrate from Fahar all the time. And so everyone in Fahar has relations that live somewhere else. And there's that sense of elsewhere that Irish people in that period particularly, I think, had a very keen awareness of. Irish people are particularly good at, if you're going to Melbourne, no, we know somebody there, you'll probably see them. That kind of thing. That sense of these sort of lines running out from the small island out into the world everywhere. And so there is that sort of those tendrils that go out from Ireland literally to everywhere. And people expect that you will bump into their cousins.
And you probably will.
Yeah.
So I love that idea, that the idea of the elsewhere is something that's shaped Fahar, as has the rain, as has the landscape. So I'm interested in some of the other forces that have shaped Fahar. So I'm going to ask you a shockingly leading question. What about infrastructure? What about something like the coming of, the electric?
So the novel This is Happiness is set during that threshold moment in Irish history when electricity, the rural electrification scheme, was announced by the government to modernise Ireland and bring electricity to the west of Ireland. And it was a shocking thing to me to realise that happened in the 50s. and that there were still people in Ireland not connected to electricity even into the early 60s. And so while I was born in Dublin in 1958 and grew up with no concept that anybody could ever have not have had electricity, when we moved in 1985 to County Clare, all of our neighbours were older people, and the main entertainment was going to them in the evening and sitting and listening to their stories and them hearing how we were trying to manage four cows. and I met for the first time people who could remember coming home from school and being allowed to be the first person in the house to turn on the electric light. And to hear also about two brothers who had the electric light turned on for them by the electricity engineer who came to connect the house, and he left and they couldn't figure out how to turn it off. And one of the brothers took a cloth to quench it like a candle, the bulb. And so these kind of stories that were still in living memory from the mid-50s was an extraordinary thing to me. And it's a threshold moment because it was the first time that the state entered into people's homes. So now they had a bill to pay, and this was a largely cashless society. People who put things on the tab and kept things noted until they would sell an animal, maybe, you know, at the next fair or so on, and then pay back the bill and so on. So they weren't used to banking. They weren't used to having an account. They weren't used to direct debits or any of those things. But suddenly they had electricity coming into the house all the time. And then also this idea that there were people then who refused to take the electricity, who saw that, said, who basically felt that things have been fine as they are. Why do we need to change? And they lived on for many years without electricity, and some people never took electricity in their lives and lived on like that. Not out of any kind of protest exactly, just out of we've been okay. So in the mid-50s in the west of Ireland, it was a threshold moment between the people who had been living in the same way since the 19th century, and then suddenly a light switch comes on and we have the 20th century crashes in 50 years after the rest of the country had been in that shape and in that world. So I think this was irresistible for me as a novelist to set This Is Happiness.
But in your latest novel, Time of the Child, which yes. came out just late last year, the electric has already come, and with it access to TV for a few lucky people, because you might have to stand outside their window to watch the show. There's national radio is listened to with a reverence that makes my public broadcasting heart swell, I have to say. But in Time of the Child, it's 1962. So what is defining Faha then? What's changed?
So Faha is stepping a little bit towards modernity. As you say, the electricity has come. All the houses in the village itself. Faha is both a village and a parish. So in the village itself, all the houses have electricity, and there's some televisions coming. The postmistress, Mrs. Prendergast, has a television, and she understands, she becomes the first person to understand that it's important to that the house, the room is for the first time turned towards the television. Previously, the couch was always turned towards the fireplace. So this is the first person to move the couch around to turn it towards the television. But also understands the importance of having a first television means that you shouldn't close the curtains, but you should let people in the street know that you've got a television. And that as you walk down the street, the glow is there. Even if it's just the test card, it's still black and white test cards still showing something of modernity about you. So we have the electricity, we have the radio and the television, and the first real tangible signifiers from America and what American television shows start to come into Irish television. Because while we started an Irish television station, we didn't really have enough budget to make Irish television programs. But it was very important not to just show English programmes, because the country was afraid of England conquering Ireland through the BBC. So they had an Irish television station with some Irish programmes, reading of poetry on television, the Angelus still there at 6 o'clock and 12 o'clock originally, and then American television shows like Dragnet, Bonanza, cowboy shows which Irish people loved and so on.
I'm so glad, though, that you mentioned there Mrs. Prendergast and her television, described in one lovely line as being, I think, as wide around as she was tall. And this town of Faha, you bring it alive with these extraordinary characters, both the ones whose lives and stories we trace in detail, but I got the sense that you were as interested in every passing character, in the other people who might yet get their own novel. So I wondered if you could introduce us to some of the people of the town, not yet the main characters in your novel, but some of the other people we meet with a reading.
With a reading, sure. One of the things that happens in this novel is we have the Christmas fair. So there are fair days, they're set out in the annual calendar each year, and they've been the same fair day since forever. And the Christmas fair is a special fair because it's the last chance to get rid of your animals so that you don't have to overwinter them. It's also the opportunity to buy a turkey if you haven't won one at cards or some other bingo or something before that. And it's an event in which everyone in the parish comes into the village. And the village's Church Street, is actually heaving with animals as people bring in cattle to sell. And at the end of that, the hawkers come, set up with vans and cars, selling goods that either are past their sell-by date or were the thing that everybody wanted about 5 years ago. So here's just a little section from the fair that day of some of the minor characters. The hawkers were a composite collection of the miscellaneous, or what could be found in the bottom of life's pockets. The judgment of the parish was that they were a tribe of melted rogues, but from a history of harmlessness and long-standing, they had become part of the furniture of the fair. The same ones came year after year, living a life without borders on the road that never ended. They had a worn-out glamour and achieved an ageless air by already looking old when they were young. There were men and women both, on the principle that all business was show business. Some men wore hats of character, feathered or banded, suits of hues and cuts not on the hangers in town. Some wore an earring, bandana, or the baggy and striped pants of Persians, were of a complexion Faha judged Spanish, had eyelashes of exquisite fineness or the one flashing gold tooth. Many had the godlike gift of remembering the names of their customers in each village. Some could go further and recall the children, what illnesses attended the family, would ask after an aged grandmother, and by a show of care, open the leather lips of a woman's purse. There was Noon, the knife sharpener, who looked like Douglas Fairbanks in the Corsican Brothers, McGreal, the pots and pans man, wire wool extra, a Dodd from the north who sold brushes, and his own version of Chimno, Sutgo, he called it. Mrs. Peggy, who sold men's underpants, 3 in the pack, and socks, 5 in the pack, all grey, good enough to wear to your own funeral. Neither of which were bought by men whose socks and underpants never surrendered, but by wives and mammies who had seen the toenail and blast damage. There was a trader who sold nothing but turps until the electricity came, when he branched out to fuses, a man with suits of clothes. I got them for next to nothing, selling them for half of that. A woman with wool, another with outfits on hangers and shoes without shoeboxes, as well as Madame Magella, whose years had not diminished her fecund look. She'd tell fortunes if she had to, but the future was passé now, perfumes and lipsticks a better line, Christian Dior and Chanel.
Niall Williams with a reading from the novel Time of the Child. I'm Kate Evans and we're here at Adelaide Writers' Week and on ABC Radio National with that image of a pack of 3 pairs of grey undies to take us through the day. So I love the way these characters, these passing characters, are so vivid and entertaining or heartbreaking. Funny too. But it's the lives of the doctor, his daughter and a skinny boy that are at the heart of the book, not to mention a baby, of course. Now, we meet the doctor first. What's happening with this man, Dr. Troy?
So Dr. Troy was a character in This Is Happiness, and the doctor had three beautiful daughters, swans of daughters, they're called. And one is now living with him, the eldest, and the others have gone away. One is married and one has gone to nursing in England. And Ronnie is with him. And so we meet them at Mass. The novel begins at Mass and ends at Mass. And we meet them at Mass on that morning when the doctor feels filled with an incurable melancholy. And he's not sure how he's going to continue living, really. And he suffers from a love that hasn't ended when the person he loved died. And so he's seeped in melancholy, and he also feels that he's a burden to his daughter, who he feels has not found love. And that's him on the first day of the novel, really.
Yes, a sort of despair and being worn out.
Worn out, yeah. Also, I think country doctors, as he is, so they have this impossible situation where everyone in the parish is his patient. And so when he's in the congregation, he knows what's wrong with everyone. And they suppose that he is remembering that all the time. And so that if they come up to him, he supposes that they're going to ask about their ailment and maybe give them some advice. And so everyone wants to, could I just have one word, doctor? Just, would you mind, doctor? That kind of situation. So he's aware of he's carrying the burden of the entire parish of what is wrong with everybody. And so they are all secret and he can't share that with anybody. So he carries the entire secrets of the parish while his own secret can't be told to anybody.
And there's also these other sort of odd constraints that seem to happen where everybody expects that he will remember their ailment.
Yes.
But they won't remind him what it is.
No.
Except for, I think, one or two characters
yes.
who bellow at him, the
yes.
bowels, it's
yes.
the bowels.
Yeah. Yeah, people are very... in Ireland, a lot of people, you know, they don't want to say the thing. It's, you know, too rude to be upfront and direct. So Ireland's a place wonderfully indirect and nuance and suggestion and don't say it. Whatever you say nothing, that Seamus Heaney line. And so, therefore, nobody wants to come out and say what's wrong with them, but they just look knowingly at the doctor and expect him to knowingly know what is wrong with them and inquire. So the novel is built on that idea of the unsaid thing.
Well, there are so many things unsaid then between the doctor and his daughter,
yes.
Ronnie,
yes.
Which means that they're both, I think, presuming things about each other's lives. And he presumes that her life is constrained, which it both is and isn't. So tell us about Veronica.
So Ronnie, we're in this old house, the surgery, where Ronnie has fallen into the role of the person who lets in the patients, sees them into the waiting room, and then the doctor ready for you now. She's that person. And she's fallen into it without ever asking for the job. It's just because she's remained at home. And so we see the doctor and Ronnie circling around each other through the course of the novel. With both of them having secrets and inner lives that they are only vaguely aware of what the other one is. And eventually the doctor understands that actually Ronnie wants to be a writer and that she is secretly writing and he is coming to the understanding that actually Fahal, though a small place, is enormous because human beings are there. And so the understanding that Ronnie comes to is that... wherever human beings are gathered, essentially, are all of humanity. You don't have to go to the city. You don't have to go to London or big Dublin even to find excitement or to find passion and so on. So she begins to see in the everyday people that are coming and going through the door some kind of understanding of the depth and breadth of human life. And that's what she begins to write about.
And on the very first page of this novel, you say Fahai is a place where nothing happens, but of course it is also a place
yes.
where everything happens.
Yeah, as I think is true almost everywhere, is absolutely, of course, true everywhere. Everything happens in anywhere, really. You just have to look at the people carefully. At this moment, any two people are gathered, an enormous amount of things are happening in the currency of their lives. And I'm also, as a novelist, I'm really aware of that my characters, besides the things that they are thinking or feeling, there are things they don't aware they're feeling, and they have bodies. So that each person here is carrying some kind of ailment today, right now, at this moment, something they're dealing with and managing, and how they're managing it, with what grace and courage and disappointments and all of those things that make up all of us all the time. And so that's why the fact that Fahad is a small place actually helps me to concentrate in.
And the thing, there's a character in this novel who I was so interested in and so terribly, terribly moved by, and that's this skinny boy waiting outside the pub for his father to pay any attention or to notice him, to catch him. And that is a boy called Jude Quinlan. So who's he?
So on the day of the fair, the second section of the novel takes place on the day of the Christmas fair, and we move to the perspective of Jude Quinlan. And Jude is this character that just came to me. I never plan a novel. I never plot it out. I never know where I'm going. I'm just trying to see what is the story here as I'm reading it. So Jude, as a character, is the person who goes to gather the cattle to bring them with his father to the mart. He has an unstable father who's unstable through gambling and alcohol. And Jude is having to be the sort of parent in that type of situation. And the fact is, it is Jude is the one who finds the baby and takes upon him that responsibility. And also partly because he has witnessed the death of his brother in a farm accident when he was younger. And he has that sense of where that brother might have gone, and that sort of vacancy of anyone who has suffered grief or suffering and has a person they've lost and it's never quite lost, gone. It's sort of still there. So it's that.
So you've mentioned the baby.
Yes.
So the miracle is the finding of a baby. So what happens?
Well, we can't tell them what happens.
what can we tell people?
So what we can tell them. So we can say that at the end of the fair day, you know, you have to imagine Fahaz is packed with people, animals, and the trading is done starting in the morning time when the farmers look at the traders, the people come to look at the animals, but nobody shows their hand. Nobody says how much they're going to pay for anything. But everyone is aware that there are banknotes in pockets, that the town is full of people walking around with banknotes in pockets, currency. And so by the afternoon, those deals are happening, and then gradually the people are adjourning into the pubs and guest house, boarding houses that have opened only as boarding houses for that day, as people are trying to make a bit of money selling soup and things like that. So gradually the whole town is either filled with cow dung, litter, the debris of the after fair, those people who are bringing home animals and so on. It's that close of evening. It's December, Christmas week before Christmas, so therefore it's dark at 4:30. And so the darkness falls, and we're in that situation where when Jude finds the baby. So he finds the baby, and he makes a decision that the first thing he's going to do with that baby is bring it to the doctor. He's not sure whether the baby's living or dead. He's never held a baby that young in his hands before, and he heads straight to the surgery with the baby, with the two Talty brothers who bring him there. And the doctor, when the baby comes to the front door, the doctor makes a decision which is to change the course of his life, his daughter's life, and the baby's life. So he tells them to come into the house with the baby, and he tells them to tell nobody. Tell nobody what has just happened. And he brings the baby in, and then they become part of that kind of confederacy, a kind of secret bond of what they're going to do. And it seemed to me that, Christine and I, Christine's here somewhere with me today, and so we adopted two children, and I have always been aware of the sort of extra responsibility of that, the chosen family, because it's not just a sort of thing that happened, it was chosen. And therefore, you have an extra responsibility to look after that child and to bring out whatever is in that child to the best of your ability, and not to impose upon it, but to let it be. But that idea of loving a stranger, which is a sort of premise, I suppose, of Christianity, but beyond that, outside of that, just a human thing as to what it means to love a child that you are not actually connected to, just this one that is in your hand. And it's a measure for all of us as to how we would respond in that moment, I think. And that's what the novel seeks to approach, yeah.
And reading this, knowing that we're in Ireland in 1962...
Yes.
And as lovely as a baby is, and as lovely as the story of a baby always is, adding to that the idea of a foundling or a lost baby or a child, we don't know how, you know, when Jude finds this baby, he doesn't know how that baby got there. So immediately, for a reader, this becomes sort of fraught and stressful, and
yes,
all of the sense of Ireland's history comes to bear. So how much were all those forces of history bearing down on you as you imagined 1962 in Ireland and what that baby means?
Yes, yeah, so the facts and the history of what happened in to children, babies in Ireland is so well documented now that I didn't need to write that, because I knew that was a force that was already there and the reader already has that sense there. And the usefulness for me is that all that force we feel is immediately outside of this room, in which this house in which his doctor and his daughter are. And so they become an island, essentially, in their house, afraid to take the baby outside or let anyone know, just that island of man, woman and baby. And obviously, because it's a Christmas set story, it has that extra element to it, and that same of the Christian story. So we have a man and a woman and a baby and the world outside waiting. And we know that essentially if the baby is brought outside that house, what's going to happen? We don't even have to write it. We already know that that energy is there. And so that sets for a novelist, that sets up a wonderful situation. And also I'm always interested in human beings that go against the norm, go against the grain, that have the courage to say, no, I'm actually going to do this instead. This is the normal thing. This is what everybody supposes, but I'm going to go this way. And so in the same way, perhaps as a novelist, aware of things that have happened and that revelations that we've had about the church and all of those kind of things, I'm interested in say, well, surely there was one good priest, and let's look at who that one was. And maybe this doctor made this decision. Let's look at how he did that, and still acknowledging the other realities, not dismissing them, but using them instead as part of the force to show human beings.
Irish writer Niall Williams, whose latest novel is Time of the Child. And yes, it's a Christmas story, among other things. I'm Kate Evans, and you're listening to a literary special here on ABC Radio National. There'll be another at the same time next week, on New Year's Day, with the writer Colm Tobin. But you need more books, you say? Well, I'll be back every week on the bookshelf too. Bye for now.